Hi, everyone. Welcome to another week of The Diamond Path. We are available on this radio station every Sunday morning at 8:30, and the show is repeated again Monday afternoons at 1:30. And I'll tell you later how you can also access this and other talks on the internet. Well, today we're going back to basics. The Four Noble Truths. Most of us have heard that term even before we came to Buddhism, probably had no idea what it was about. But the Four Noble Truths is the essence of Buddhism. It's the first thing that the Buddha recognized sitting in meditation under the Bodhi tree that night. It was his first great realization, and it pretty well covers the whole area of suffering, why we do it, and how to get out of it. So this is the seminal. If one is on the Buddhist path, you cannot even begin to approach it without at least a rudimentary understanding of these, which will grow as you contemplate them and get into the path further. If you're not, or don't have no intention of being on the Buddhist path, this is still a seminal instruction on the methods used in a Buddhist path. And of course, I've always stated this, that the Buddhist path is not specifically a Buddhist path. It's a path out of suffering. It's available to everyone. So the Four Noble Truths, I'll read them first, and then we'll kind of go through some of them. The first noble truth is that all existence is characterized by suffering. The second noble truth is that suffering is caused by attachments. The third noble truth is that there is indeed an end to suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, and that's how we get out of suffering. Now, the first two have been, they were recognized for probably thousands of years before Buddha ever came on the scene. After all, that's what spiritual seeking is all about. No matter what path we choose, either in the ancient times or now, it's all about relating to something that is greater than us. And by recognizing that, most of these traditions understand that suffering is lessened. And that is valid on any path. And any path that reduces suffering makes it that a valid path, increases happiness and reduces suffering. So let's start right from the beginning then. All of existence is characterized by suffering. Now, as I've said before, most of us in the West don't latch onto this very readily, and I can see why. The word suffering actually comes from a Sanskrit word called dukkha, which can also be translated as dissatisfactory. Now, that's much closer. We in the West, for the most part, live pretty sheltered lives. We don't have a lot of trauma and death and plenty of taxes. But, you know, the tragedies that befall most of us are minor compared to many others in the world. They are truly suffering. We are often dissatisfactory and have dissatisfactory lives and feel discomforts because of it. So some of the things that characterizes suffering are the big ones that I talked about: birth, sickness, and death. That we can all pretty much climb on board with. But it goes right down to like not getting things we want and getting things we don't want. I mean, we may not be suffering, but at some point, somebody else's unskillful act will send us into a little tizzy. Maybe they pushed our buttons when we weren't ready. And, you know, for the next few hours, we're miserable. We're depressed. That's discontent. That's suffering. It's not like having a building fall on you during an earthquake or being shot by some rebel group somewhere. But it hurts us. We suffer. And then conversely, there's times when we have things that we really, really like our birthday party. If you're having a good birthday and you've got people over and having a great time, we just want it to continue. So by the time the night's over and everybody's gone home and you've done all the dishes and you're sitting there, you may not feel as good as you did earlier, and you miss that. That's a little discontent. All of these discontents add up to a life not of discontent. Many of us lead very happy lives. But inevitably, there's death. Inevitably, there's death of spouses. Inevitably, there's the death of things or people we care about. So suffering exists, and wouldn't it be neat if we could figure out how to avoid it? So this was understood in Buddha's time and for thousands of years prior, that life has that element of suffering to it. And even way back, well before Buddha, suffering was the suspected cause of suffering was desires and attachments, because it was pretty obvious to see when we don't get what we want, we're unhappy. So I think they kind of figured, well, this has something to do with it. We're not happy. And if we're not happy, we're suffering to some degree or another. So what can we do about it? Well, Buddha's great revelation was that there was something to be done about it. And he simply stated as much in the Third Noble Truth, where he simply declared there is an end to suffering. And that end to suffering is to eliminate our attachments and our misplaced desires and our unskillful actions and those sort of things. But it's mostly about desires and attachment here in the third one. To end suffering, take away the attachments. If we're not attached to an outcome, if we're not attached to an object or a person, then we can't be hurt if it's taken away. And of course, when you're talking about loving someone, that's an attachment. And we generally recognize, and the Buddhists would certainly recognize, that that's a good thing. But someday a spouse may die, and we have the ability to go on or to completely fall apart. So in a case like this, yes, love, desire is a good thing. But the loss of it, the lack of it, has to be a lesson to us. We have to look at that as an attachment. Even the Buddhist path, Buddha said this, that the Buddhist path is like a raft. If you get to a river, and this is the metaphorical river of one shore representing where we are now and the other shore representing awakening, we take the raft over that river to get to awakening. We use the Buddhist path as a raft to get over there. But once you're there, you don't carry the raft on your back. You put it down. So even the Buddhist path is not to be attached to. It's just a tool. So the fourth noble truth is the eightfold path. And that's how we find our way out of suffering. So as you might imagine, this path can be fairly lengthy. I do believe I can get a decent introduction here. But if needs be, we'll have another show on it. In fact, we certainly will have another show on it, because we revisit these things over and over again at our Sangha. And nobody ever objects, because every time you hear it, there's a word or two that suggests a little deeper meaning. So we keep going over this stuff over and over and over again. And each time we hear something fresh. Okay, so the Eightfold Path. And I will read those really quickly and then we'll go into them. Number one, right view or understanding. Two, right thought. Three, right speech. Four, right action. Five, right livelihood. Six, right effort. Seven, right mindfulness. And eight, right concentration. Now, just about all Buddhist lists, and let me tell you, there's a number of them, there's always a sequence. And they're to be somewhat understood in that sequence. But it's also recognized that we don't follow a path, step one, step two, step three, step four. They're all accessed simultaneously. They're all part of our life when we're on this path. And you may spend all day in number seven and not have a really good handle on number two yet, or something like that. So it's there when you need it, and you access it at many levels, and it usually happens all at once. All right, so let's go through these. Right view or understanding. This speaks a bit about the whole idea of understanding that there is a way out of suffering. Things like the ego, which is really unsubstantial because it's part of this network, this emptiness that we've talked about before, that the ego of the person should not be seen as this substantial entity. Impermanence, it's a view, this right view or understanding includes the understanding that all of life is impermanent, both from our temporary emotions and predilections, the impermanence and temporary aspect of our lives, lives of our loved ones, and even of the universe and of mountains, and everything is impermanent. Which an understanding, and this talks back to the ego again, is the dependently arisen factors that influence us. This idea that, as I spoke about last week, about how environmental factors impact the body and the mind, things coming from without help create who we are. This is dependently arisen factors. We think that we are we because we are we, but in truth we are we because of everything else out there that's helped create us. So this is an aspect of right understanding. So, and all of this then speaks to just kind of developing a knowledge and an insight as to how the world actually works. Now, this definitely can be seen as an entry-level thing. How could you possibly embrace any of this if you didn't think that some of these things were true? That, yes, indeed, you may not get it all yet, but I think on the whole, we could recognize that developing knowledge and insight into how the world works is a right step. And if you look at the Buddhist suggestion on how to start this step, which is understanding things like impermanence and dependent arising and that sort of stuff, you now have a view or an understanding that allows you to start this path out. And then the second of the Eightfold Path is right thought. And that, once again, it seems to mirror somewhat the first one in that you're developing this clarity of insight into how life works. You look at your own mind, the right thought would be looking at the mind again and recognizing the greed, the violence, the ill will, and anger towards others. Right thought takes all of these into consideration. We see these. And as a right thought, we understand that that's not a very skillful way of living. So right thought talks about freedom from unhealthy states of mind, freedom from our habits and our emotional hang-ups, and the freedom from having a button that's too easily pushed by others. These two, by the way, I forgot to mention this up front, the Eightfold Path is broken into three areas. The first two, right view or understanding and right thought, come under proper view, which kind of helps spell that out. How can you start a path unless you have some proper view of what this path means? So the first two are proper view. The second three are proper conduct. And they conclude number 3, right speech, 4, right action, 5, right livelihood. Now, right speech. Speech is very important. It's the main vehicle that connects people. If we have ideas, feelings, yeah, you can touch, you can kiss, and all of that's certainly valid, but speech is the main vehicle for coming from me to you. So what I say is very important because it's going to affect you. You're going to hear something. If I don't say it right, you may hear something I didn't mean to say. Right speech would be things like gossiping about others. Right speech would be talking about others in an unskillful way to their face. Right speech, of course, would be about lying in all its forms, any untruth. If you're trying to relate to another person and what you're telling them is incorrect and in a deliberate, intentional way, then that's not right speech. So anything that can be conceived of as right speech, which would also be talking ill about others as a group, someone standing up at a pulpit or a lectern and telling the audience that this whole group of people had no worth or were this or that or whatever. So right speech, that main vehicle that brings my thoughts to you, should be a speech that brings good thoughts and not bad thoughts. It should bring less suffering, not more suffering. Right action. This covers everything from murder down to improper jaywalking, you know. Right action is once again viewed from a skillful, unskillful meter. We measure, is our actions creating more suffering in this person and ultimately maybe me? Or is this action creating less suffering? Anytime we can answer that question with less suffering, that's generally considered to be the right action. Even though it's not specifically mentioned in any of these, stealing, forgery, any number of crimes is an improper action. Anything that's going to take something away from someone unjustly, anything that's going to bring something upon someone else unjustly, these are all examples of not right action. So right action, then, would be that everything we do has that sense of morality, that sense of ethics, that sense of recognizing in the other someone who demands and needs to demand our respect. someone who will benefit, hopefully, from our actions. As I said, many actions, much speech, much of everything, even back to last week's talk about the skandhas, the neutral thing comes out probably most of the time. In many of our interactions, they're just neutral. But so often, a little tweak can make it positive, you know, that old smile at the clerk checking you out kind of thing. So right action could even be that, smiling more. But it's not a call necessarily to go out and do good things in this context. Right action is simply everything one does should be mindful and respectful. Right livelihood. There's a couple examples that I throw out right away that would not be good examples of right livelihood, and that would be someone like an arms manufacturer, or drug dealers, or arms merchants, or people who promote, as their business, promote hate in one form or another, books, pamphlets, creating speeches, that sort of thing. But generally, we can look at right livelihood and simply ask, you know, is this business or this business products or this business's day-by-day activities, and specifically, of course, if you're in that business, is my business, are the people I work for, exploiting others, creating suffering elsewhere so we could have a better tennis shoe, or any number of products and services that will tend to create more suffering. Those are examples of livelihoods that would not fall under this category. So right livelihood is virtually everything else that can be just mundane, but even the mundane is usually a service to somebody. So everything we do has to fall and should fall under right livelihood. And then there's areas like one of our priests. He lives down in West Virginia, and I think he no longer works for them, but during his ordination process, during his training, he was a used car salesman, and he had a lot of struggles with that. But that can be done correctly. You don't have to tell this person that there's 10,000 less miles on this car. You can be honest. You can be a used car salesman and have it and make it a right livelihood. Or you could take the unethical route, and then it is no longer right livelihood. So there's a lot of – it's hard to cubbyhole all these jobs and say, yeah, that one's good, that one's bad. It's really all how we treat it. How do we operate in that business or in our livelihood. So that was the second three. That was proper conduct. That's how we relate to others. The last three, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, they fall under the general category of proper practice. Proper practice. This is how we get to the mind that does right livelihood, right action, and right speech. This is how we completely develop and bring to fruition right thought and right view. So right effort would be the first one in proper practice. And right effort speaks to the effort, the energy that we put into our practice. If we think all of these things are great ideas on a philosophical level, and yeah, they're cool, yeah, I agree, that kind of stuff, yeah, that's accessing some truths and maybe internalizing them somewhat. But until you put some effort into it, we don't get very far. If we're going to sit in meditation and we find it confusing, that we can't keep our mind still and we just throw our hands up and get up and go do something else, that's lacking that right effort. Right effort means that if I'm going to get this stuff, nobody's going to make me understand it. There's all this information out there, but I'm not going to get it if I just read it. The intellectual area of bringing knowledge is very important, especially in Tendai. It's part of our practice. That's why we have a talk every week. We talk about these things. We have to talk about things on an intellectual level before we even get to the next step. In some cases, other people just grok it right away. But this effort, this making an effort to focus our mind in meditation, making an effort to focus our concentration in our heart, in all of our practices, whatever they may be. Tendai has a lot, other schools have less, but a practice in this sense is also the practice of the previous three steps, right speech, right action, right livelihood. That's all right effort. It's going to take effort not to shout at somebody who's just come down on you for something, however wrong or right, you know, you never know. They just yelled at you and you get upset. it takes an effort to back off that instant desire to react. It's not even a desire, it's a reaction. I mean, it's based on desires, but it's that reaction thing that we have to use effort to quell. And same with the speech and the action and just about everything else we do. It takes effort. It's not going to come without effort. Number 7, right mindfulness, is, first of all, an effort to understand oneself, starting with the body. Right mindfulness means being aware of one's body and all that means. Is it healthy? Does it hurt? Does it feel good? If I'm doing practice, just being aware of what the body feels like in a position, being aware of our balance point, being aware of our lungs, our breath, are they filled with liquids? I mean, you know, some of us obsess about this stuff, so it's no problem for some people. But in general, being aware of one's body is a very seminal part of right mindfulness, because as we talked about last week, that's where it all starts. Right mindfulness is about being aware of one's feelings and emotions and thoughts and even impulses at a particular time, what I was talking about before. Being aware that if somebody manages to shake up your core and you're all upset, to not react, you're aware that your feelings and your emotions are creating this reaction, creating these thoughts. So at any given time, you can put right mindfulness into play. You're looking at these feelings and emotions, and you're aware of it. And being aware of something means you have some control over it. Right mindfulness includes your whole panoply of ideas and views. Why do I believe the way I do? What do I believe? You know, examining one's thought patterns, examining one's belief structures should be almost a daily practice. It is a true practice. Why am I a Catholic? Why am I a Buddhist? Why do I like this particular position on a voting booth? You know, yes or no? Why am I even doing this? Question everything. Be aware of why we have these thoughts. I mean, this is us. Our views and our ideas and our actions that follow, that's us. You got to be aware of this stuff. And then the fourth aspect, I didn't even number these, it's not important, but the fourth aspect of right mindfulness is the aware of the true nature of things. And this speaks back to the stuff that I brought up in the first couple steps, the impermanence, the insubstantiality of things, the dissatisfactoriness of nature. The Buddhist truths and how they impact us is the fourth and very important part of right mindfulness. In other words, it's about us. First, we're mindful of who we are, the body, the feelings, emotions, all that, the ideas and the views. But then we take us and put us out there. We put us out there with all these Buddhist truths. What is my relationship, my awareness of me in relation to impermanence? Like, I know I'm going to die. What's my relationship with this non-substantial nature of things? Well, that's what we talked about last week, the skandhas. Skandhas have been this description of our ego and how it was built. And when we recognize that this whole structure is not based on anything solid, it's just based on these thoughts and emotions and attachments, we start to, and when we start seeing the impact of environment, whether physical, chemical, electromagnetical, or other people's emotions, it's all environmental. Whatever comes at us from the outside helps create who we are. So the non-substantial nature of self speaks to this idea that we are a continual creation of what's going on at the moment, both from within ourselves and from without. So we have to be aware of how we fit into that thing, aware of our place in this self-non-self debate. And then, of course, the whole concept of suffering, the dissatisfactoriness of life. So we have to be aware of our own emotions, our own feelings about how we view life, the nature of our life in this fabric of understanding. And the last step, step number 8, is right concentration. Now, right concentration speaks back to the meditation that we've talked about a number of times, and that's one-pointedness of concentration. I remember last week talking about the benefits of meditation and how we develop the ability to pay attention on one thing. We start with a breath, or it could be an object, but the whole idea is to be able to concentrate one's entire attention at one point. Now just imagine, it's like a magnifying glass. Once you hold that magnifying glass up to anything, everything else becomes fuzzy or at least irrelevant, and you're concentrating on the focal point, that one spot of illumination. That's what right concentration is. It's the ability to use this mind that's been developed through the first seven into a mind that can see with clarity, with insight, and with this concentration. And with that, wisdom comes. I mean, wisdom comes through the development of all of these. As I said, this is a thing that we approach from all directions, and we take each step different times. And in truth, most people enter through the middle three, the proper conduct. If they understand somewhat that this is a good path, well, I know I gotta speak right, and I have to have a job that is a decent job, not hurting anybody, and I gotta do right action. But all of it comes into play every day when we follow this path. And so if you had to sum up most of this eightfold path, it's basically paying attention. Paying attention to you and to everything else out there. Well, that was about it for today. We'll be revisiting the Four Noble Truths a few different times, maybe in different ways. But as I said earlier, this is really the core of Buddhist teaching. Everything else that Buddha ever said and everything that we have ever followed in this path has come from the Four Noble Truths. So this is it. It would help to pick up a couple of books on this, just to have it in front of you to refer to it. So this is the Diamond Path. I'm Sancho Tamarack Garlow. I'm the leader of Higashi Tendai Buddhist Sangha in Great Barrington. And we, together with Andy Potter of the Housatonic Radio Works, have put this show together for you, and we hope you enjoy it. If you'd like to learn more about Buddhism, please call me. We do meet every Monday at East Mountain Retreat Center in Great Barrington. We'd love to have you come up, check it out. We're for everybody. It's not just for Buddhists. It's for anybody who's just the least bit curious and would like to see maybe a spiritual path developed in their practice. So give me a call at 413-229-3263. And you can also access old talks of this. Our archives are on the web, including this one you just heard today, at diamondpath.blogspot.com. So until next week, peace, everyone.